American Literature Podcast on The Scarlet Letter, chapters 19 through 24. Last time on The Scarlet Letter, Hester and Dimmesdale rekindled their affection during a hopeful moment in the forest, but Pearl, dressed like a forest spirit, came slowly back. Slowly, Hawthorne tells us, for she saw the clergyman! Exclamation point. This is the fourth of four podcasts on this book. I'm assuming you know how it ends, and you're ready to look again at this section. What do we make of the fact that Pearl is so reluctant? Everything about chapter 19, from Hester's opening sentence, "Thou wilt love her dearly," future tense, to Dimmesdale's concern that as Pearl grows, she's going to look more and more like her father, Hester's reminder that they need but wait a little more for freedom, and the fact that Hester and Dimmesdale are watching what Hawthorne calls Pearl's slow advance. Everything about this chapter seems to be working against this excitement that Hester and Dimmesdale felt in chapter 18, this sunny promise of escape that they really wanted to rush forwards to. Now, Hester is here speaking conditionally, perhaps even with uncertainty, when she says, "She may be strange and shy at first, but will soon learn to love thee." Again, there's future tense. Now, as I've noted in my podcasts before, when Hawthorne uses a literary device, he makes certain that we notice it. And here, he's placing Pearl at the margin of the brook and says that Hester felt estranged from Pearl, as if the child had strayed outside of the sphere in which she and her mother dwelt together, and was now vainly seeking to return to it. But Hawthorne points out that it was not Pearl who wandered away from Hester, but rather Hester who had estranged Pearl by admitting Dimmesdale within the circle of her feelings. Frowning, Pearl points to the scarlet letter, while her mother, and I love the imagery of this line, her mother still kept beckoning to her and arraying her face in a holiday suit of unaccustomed smiles. Now, Pearl is not fooled by the fake smiles. She has a tantrum, and Hawthorne suggests that the forest is joining in. It seemed as if a hidden multitude were lending her their sympathy and encouragement. I often run across readings that try to argue that Hester's A is a badge of honor, that she wears it because she's a proud individual. But in this chapter, she calls it a hateful token. It's now lying on the edge of the stream, but Hester says she wishes she could throw it in the ocean. Yet in this scene, she admits she is right, that is, Pearl is right. Pearl's horror is justified, and Hester agrees she has to keep wearing it. With Hester once again properly labeled, Pearl happily leaps across this brook back into her mother, kisses her mother, and then kisses that letter. Now, after asking Dimmesdale again whether he will hold their hands in public, and after hearing again the answer no, that's when Pearl rejects Dimmesdale's kiss, and back to the brook she goes to wash it off. Hawthorne makes sure that the reader understands Pearl, whom I've called the freest character in the book, and who speaks wisdom on numerous occasions. Hawthorne makes sure the reader understands Pearl does not approve of this secret plan of escape. And I think that prepares us to accept that something is not right. At the end of the chapter, this brook, this same sad brook that was so important to set up the sadness and loneliness of Hester in the previous section, this brook keeps up its murmuring babble with not a whit more cheerfulness of tone. Now, on this somber note, chapter 20 follows Dimmesdale on his way back from this meeting. He's heading back into town, and he's kind of euphoric from this meeting with Hester. But again, something's wrong. Now, this chapter has several structural similarities with Young Goodman Brown. Again, we have a two-faced man who's made a risky moral decision, and he's journeying through the woods. Now, Brown made his decision in town, and was going out to the forest to carry it out. Dimmesdale made his decision in the forest, and we're following him on his journey back into town life. Now, on his way back to town, he plays the role of tempter to the people that he meets. Or, at least in his mind, he's tempted to play that role of tempter, tempted to shock and twist the people he comes across. This pious old deacon, the old widow, the young woman who secretly loves Dimmesdale, and those little children. He's tempted finally at the end to teach naughty words to those children. Well, he just barely manages to control himself and keep from doing these horrible things that he's tempted to do. Now, one of my students the other day pointed out that in this scene, Dimmesdale, who usually puts his hand on his heart, in this scene, here he strikes his forehead, and this is right before he meets Mistress Hibbins, the witch lady. And Hibbins interprets his presence in the wood as evidence that he was convorting with the potentate of the dark woods. Now, Dimmesdale here, with his hand on his forehead, he's defending himself. It's kind of a lame defense. He omits any reference to the visit with Hester, but he gives the reason for why he was out in the forest. He's coming back from doing good works farther out in the wilderness. And Mistress Hibbins says, "Well, well, we must needs talk thus in the daytime. You carry it off like an old hand." And she sort of, you know, it's a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Yes, that's the way we have to talk. Good job for lying. Now, here Dimmesdale makes a decision. Tempted by a dream of happiness, he had yielded himself with deliberate choice, as he had never done before, to what he knew was deadly sin. Okay, so what is this deadly sin that he's just deliberately chosen? Well, we'll get back to that in a second. A little later, Dimmesdale returns home. He goes to the sermon that he had started to write. And Hawthorne tells us that his other self was gone. Another man had returned out of the forest. A wiser one. Okay, why is he wise now? Who is this Dimmesdale now who sits down and writes this sermon? He does an all-nighter and finishes his sermon. He throws out the old sermon and starts over again. Is this the Dimmesdale who agreed to run away with Hester? Well, no. That Dimmesdale was the one who was tempted to teach cursed words to the children and do all those other naughty things on his journey from the forest back into town. That Dimmesdale was the one who was stunned by old Mistress Hibbins's winking acceptance of his fallen nature. And it's this wiser Dimmesdale, the different Dimmesdale, that does an all-nighter writing a new sermon. Chapter 21 focuses on Hester mentally saying her goodbyes to the community she thinks she's about to depart. She doesn't know what we just saw in chapter 20, where we see Dimmesdale almost driven mad by the consequences of agreeing to flee and leave his sin unconfessed before the community. Now, Hawthorne takes a moment in chapter 21 to explain that the Puritans in New England were not all drab and bitter, at least not all their lives. Most of them, he says, were native Englishmen. And back in the old country, they were merry and joyful. And today, on this holiday, we see an echo of this merriment that they must have remembered, even though, you know, we don't see it in their regular lives. Their immediate posterity, Hawthorne tells us, the generation next to the early emigrants, wore the blackest shade of Puritanism, and so darkened the national visage with it that all the subsequent years have not sufficed to clear it up. We have yet to learn again the forgotten art of gaiety. I've mentioned several times in these podcasts that Hawthorne is not himself the same as the Puritan characters that he represents, and this is some very clear language that indicates Hawthorne is deeply critical of this Puritan culture. Though he himself is a product of it, indirectly. And here he says all of American culture is a product of this aspect of Puritanism, too. Now, I think the story would be one thing if Dimmesdale had learned in advance that their plan to escape by ship has been scuttled. And after having learned that, if he did the next best thing and confessed himself to death before the whole town. But when Hester learns from the sea captain that Chillingworth is coming on the ship too, the procession is already underway. Now, at this dramatic moment, Hawthorne halts the story to describe this procession. It's a parade of soldiers and, you know, music and officials and, of course, the ministers. And this tension, as we know the plot is developing, but Hester can't do anything. Well, the fact that Hawthorne pauses to describe the procession kind of emphasizes that tension. We're powerless. We share Hester's inability to act. We can't make the story progress, at least until this parade gets by. Now, Hester gets a good enough look at Dimmesdale as he passes, but there's absolutely no evidence that Hester, that I could find, that Hester communicates anything to Dimmesdale. He doesn't acknowledge her presence. Dimmesdale, he seems to be in his old world, in his own world. There's no glance or anything that Hester can communicate to him. Hester says, or thinks, and was this the man? She hardly knew him now. Now, Pearl is nattering on about running up to the minister and asking him for a kiss, but Hester tells her, really, in effect, what happens in the forest stays in the forest. Hibbins walks up to Hester, and now Dimmesdale and Hester don't realize this, but Hibbins really is playing the role of the black man from Young Goodman Brown. She goes to Hester and she tempts her, saying, "Surely, couldst thou surely tell Hester whether he was the same man that encountered thee on the forest path?" Mistress Hibbins, who, remember, we're told she will soon be executed on suspicion of witchcraft, Hibbins asks, "What is Dimmesdale hiding under that hand that he places on his breast?" Now, Pearl has asked this question numerous times before, and there's a little connection here between Pearl and Mistress Hibbins, but Pearl soon runs off through the crowd. She's cavorting around. Hawthorne tells us that these strict Puritans who are watching her, even though they disapprove of her, they might be smiling anyway. Pearl stares down an Indian, and she attracts the attention of a sailor who tries to chase her to give her a kiss. And this sailor instead decides to throw her a golden chain. Now, I wonder a bit about that golden chain. Hawthorne tells us, "Pearl immediately twined it around her neck and waist with such happy skill that once seen there, it became a part of her, and it was difficult to imagine her without it." Now, the gold chain reminds us of the gold thread in her red dress and, of course, of the scarlet letters, decorations. But here at this moment, as Hester sees her dreams of escape fading, Pearl is not being chained down by Puritan New England, this New England that has crushed the happy English spirit of her ancestors. Here, Pearl is refusing to be caught by a sailor, and she happily embraces, she appropriates this pirate's gold. It's freedom, excitement, risk, whatever. Whatever it is, it's a gesture that seems very empowering. Or is she a slave to passion? Is she a slave to worldly pursuit? Is Hawthorne warning us that she's going to be, you know, chained up by a love of material goods? Now, we can use what we do know about Pearl's future to conclude that this is a positive image, whatever Hawthorne intended. Now, I think it's a stroke of real brilliance that Hester cannot actually hear what Dimmesdale is saying during his triumphal speech, during the speech he gives in the church. Now, at this point, we know more than either Hester or Dimmesdale. We know that Hester knows their escape is cut off, and we also know that the thought of escape made Dimmesdale, you know, he was almost insane. And this new, wiser man, we know, has a different plan. We don't know exactly what that plan is, though. Now, the speech over, the procession returns, and here Dimmesdale calls Hester and Pearl up to the platform. While Pearl in the forest was reluctant to come to Dimmesdale's side, and she rejects his affection when he refuses to meet her in public, she eagerly rushes to him here in public, and Hawthorne tells us that Hester came slowly, as if impelled by inevitable fate against her strongest will. This, of course, is not the reunion that Hester wants, but it's the one Pearl has wanted for years. Chillingworth comes forward once more to offer escape from public shaming. He phrases it as salvation and helping, but Dimmesdale rejects his offer and turns instead to Hester. The help that Dimmesdale is accepting from Hester, the escape that he's thinking of, it's not the escape that Hester tried to arrange, but it's clearly the escape that he's chosen for himself. At this climax, after confessing his sinful nature to all the public, he tears open his shirt, and Hawthorne tells us, "It was revealed!" Exclamation point. But he carefully avoids telling us exactly what was revealed. As he lies there dying, Dimmesdale will not confirm Hester's hopeful suggestion that their suffering has redeemed each other. He only says, "God knows, and he is merciful." Dimmesdale, with his dying words, credits Chillingworth for torturing him to the point where he can finally make the right decision. He credits this opportunity to make a public confession, and both of these, he says, combined, have saved his soul. Now, there is even more uncertainty at the end of the novel, when Hawthorne very carefully avoids telling us exactly what happens to Pearl. We do know that her kiss to Dimmesdale and her tears were the pledge that she would grow up amid human joy and sorrow, nor forever do battle with the world, but be a woman in it. Towards her mother, too, Pearl's errand as a messenger of anguish was fulfilled. We don't see any more of Pearl's actions in the story, so we kind of have to take Hawthorne's word for it. Her errand as a messenger of anguish for her mother was fulfilled, and Pearl grows up a woman in the world. The final chapter offers several theories as to what might have been on the minister's breast and what was its significance. Dimmesdale, in his death, still seems heroic to his followers. They're able to find good in his actions. And Hawthorne tells us the reader may choose among these various theories that Hawthorne represents and that the people are kicking around themselves. Hawthorne writes, "Among the many morals which press upon us from the poor minister's miserable experience, we put only this into a sentence. Be true, be true, be true. Show freely to the world, if not your worst, yet some trait whereby the worst may be inferred." It's really a call for humility, a call for exposing our flaws and weaknesses as a way of living truthfully with the other imperfect people around us, something that young Goodman Brown could not do, something that Dimmesdale is not really able to do. We hear of the fate of Chillingworth, who dies soon after the events of the novel. We do not read of a dramatic deathbed conversion, but what can we conclude from the fact that he willed his fortune to Pearl? Now, years later, Hester returns alone to her small house, and Hawthorne writes, "On the threshold she paused." Hawthorne invites us to consider that pause as a sign she knows she's making an important decision, and again, this is another threshold, another barrier that Hawthorne asks us to pay attention to. Hester returns to this location of her sin. She's presented here as acknowledging that her act was sinful, and that she still needs to pay for that. Now, I'll let you read these last few pages yourself if you like, noting that Hester speaks hopefully of a new age, but says that she herself is not the prophetess who will bring it about. She looks ahead instead to a woman indeed, but lofty, pure and beautiful and wise, moreover not through dusky grief, but the ethereal medium of joy, and showing how sacred love should make us happy by the truest test of life successful to such an end. Now, the final line of the novel, Hawthorne tells us, is a herald's wording, a heraldry, that's, you know, the visual language of symbolism on family crests. And the language is translates as, on a green field, the letter A, red. Now, is this the green of the forest? Is it unified with the red of the letter? Or are they still in conflict? On that open note, I hope it'll encourage you to return to the ending for a closer look. On that open note, I'll close this podcast. I hope you enjoyed reading through The Scarlet Letter and discussing it through these podcasts, and I will see you in class.